all. I want to wrap up the discussion we were having yesterday about indirect tests of the standard model, just to talk about what some of the new physics implications could be, and a couple of other examples of where we might be seeing weird things. And then we'll move on to the main topic of the day, which will be neutrinos and flavor physics. So if you recall where we left off, we were talking about how in the electroweak theory predicts all sorts of correlations between production rates, for instance, for right and left-handed particles, for this in turn feeds into angular distributions, that the masses, for instance, the mass of the Z and the mass of the W are linked together by this relationship from electroweak symmetry breaking. So what we can do is do a bunch of calculations of observables in terms of standard model parameters and then do a fit, okay? And the fit looked pretty good, but because of this weird CDF measurement of the W boson mass, if we put that in, then we find our fit suddenly looking not so good. Okay, and Manuela gave us a really excellent overview of the experimental kind of realities of that, so I won't weigh in on that anymore. But a thing that you can do is take it seriously and just see what the implications would be. If for no other reason, it's kind of an exercise of, if we were to actually confirm that measurement, what are the physics implications? So there's two ways we can assess the goodness of fit. One is the so-called posterior way, where essentially you do a fit and then you look at the individually measured value from that one experiment that measured that thing and see how far off they are. And you can see when you do that, pretty much everything looks good except for the W mass. Right? The W mass is like way off of what the prediction is. So this pull is roughly the number of standard deviations or number of error bars you have to be away to reconcile the experimental measurement to the result from the fit. Okay, so the fit really wants the W mass to be much less than what CDF measures it to be. That discrepancy is almost 5 sigma if you take the error bars seriously. As Manuel said, how do you combine measurements that are discrepant to come up with like a measurement of the W boson mass? That's a hard thing to do. So what the HEPFIT group did was they took this conservative scenario where they basically inflated the error bars to try and cover both the ATLAS and the CDF results. It's still not great. It's like 3 sigma. Okay, and you can see that like if you instead remove one parameter from the fit, do your fit, and then for instance, let's take the Z boson mass. I don't include the Z boson mass observable in my fit. My fit predicts parameters of the standard model allow me to calculate the Z boson mass, and then I can compare it to the observation. And you can see that you get these kind of wild fluctuations.
What does pull mean in this graph?
So pull is So if you imagine I have like the fit has some chi-squared, so there's some distribution of what the observable is, and then I have my experimental error bar. You see like how many error bars are these two central values away from one another. Okay, so we can look at just the p-value of the fit as a whole. Okay, it's very small if you take at face value the CDF measurement, 4.2 sigma away from the standard model prediction. If you do this conservative averaging, actually, it looks like there are these like 6 sigma things. But remember, sigma, taking an error bar to be a sigma only makes sense if you have a Gaussian distribution, right? And this is not going to be very Gaussian because we have these inflated error bars. So what this is telling us is that even though things look like they're bad, if you kind of artificially inflate the error bars and you correctly propagate your errors and don't use a Gaussian estimate, actually, in the conservative case, the p-value is not awful. But you somehow need to reconcile these two measurements. So so that's where the state of the standard model is for this. So then what you can do is say, well, if the standard model is not a great fit, then what if we add extra things? So Manuel talked about this idea of a standard model effective field theory, where you try to capture all of the effects of heavy new physics in additional terms in your Lagrangian. You can do this in a systematic way where you first include the most important terms. So basically, these are three examples of fits where you're adding new terms. So some of you may have heard of these things called the Peskin-Takeuchi parameter is ST and U. Okay, ST and U capture kind of the leading effects of a lot of interesting new physics. So one of the things that S does is if you have new particles that are gaining part of their mass through the standard model Higgs mechanism, then that contributes to the S parameter. The T parameter changes the relationship between the W and Z boson mass. So for instance, if instead of having just a doublet Higgs field, you had a doublet Higgs field and a triplet Higgs field, then you can change that, make corrections to that mass prediction. So basically what you're doing is you're adding more parameters, which of course will give you a better fit. What's interesting is that just by adding like two parameters, the goodness of fit becomes much, much better. And you can just see that, like, you know, now the W mass in all of these three things is pretty consistent with the actual W, you know, various other observables, you know, they all kind of look pretty good. So what that's telling us is that this is not like a weird signal. In fact, there's lots of new physics models that you just like add something, and this is this W mass anomaly is exactly what you would see from that model. So in that sense, it's kind of exciting because it's like, this is not, you have to add some weird, you know, Lorentz breaking, some crazy thing. This is something that maybe we could have predicted. So the real issue here is not really on the theory side, but more on the experiment side, that we have these different experimental measurements that are in conflict with one another. If they resolve in the direction of CDF, then everyone will be very excited. And if they resolve in the direction of ATLAS, you know, such is life. So we'll have to wait and see. But it you know, kind of shows how tricky some of these precision measurements are, because you're really sensitive to how well you're nailing down your experimental measurement. So a couple of other weird things that we see, and I'm mentioning these not because I think that they're the most compelling things, but because they're the only things. So in some sense, like the fact that, you know, we're seeing weird tensions and all, and that there's not a clean explanation, it's also just a manifestation of the fact that, like, really, you know, the standard model seems to be holding up very, very well under testing. So probably most of you have heard about this. If you've taken a quantum field theory course, you all have done some, you know, radiative correction to the anomalous magnetic dipole moment of a charged particle. So this is the loop calculation shown here. And of course, loops are sensitive to all the things that can run in the loops. So we can now measure this at the, you know, 9 decimal place accuracy. And so we have to include many loops of particles. And for the electroweak interactions and QED, that's pretty straightforward. I mean, it's not straightforward to actually do the calculation, but they're very smart people who know how to do like for loop calculations, and they do it. Okay. The hard thing is that you can also have a two-loop graph like the one on the right, where the photon that's correcting your vertex has a loop of hadrons in it. Problem is that muon mass is like 100 MeV, and at 100 MeV, the strong interactions are non-perturbative. So if you just were to include quarks in that loop, that would not actually give you the correct physics, right? So you have to actually include the strong interaction physics, and we don't actually know how to calculate this. So the way that this is usually treated is to use properties like unitarity of the theory. So probably, hopefully, you've heard of the optical theorem, which relates parts of the scattering amplitude to parts of the overall rate. So what you can do is take experimental measurements of, say, electron positron annihilating to hadrons, and use that to get information about the amplitude involving a photon coupling to hadrons. Okay. So that we can't calculate, but you can measure. And then there are ways that you can use unitarity and analyticity and other things to extrapolate that and make a measurement or a prediction for what that hadronic contribution is. And this is the dominant theory uncertainty. So when you follow that procedure, you get an estimate for, this is G minus 2 over 2. This is a mu. We're multiplying it by 10 to the 9. So this is really, you know, 18.5 times 10 to the minus 9. So here is the prediction from that procedure that I mentioned. And of course, in April 2021, the new Fermilab G minus 2 result came out, and it's over here, okay, confirming the Brookhaven result, which was from many, many, many years ago. Okay, so here, actually, this is the opposite of the W mass situation, because the experiments are kind of in agreement with one another, so that's exciting. Okay, we can ask what could be the source of this discrepancy. One is just a statistical fluctuation. It's about a 4 sigma anomaly. And there's a reason why particle physicists set 5 sigma as their threshold. It's because 4 sigma anomalies go away sometimes. They're not as rare as 5 sigma. So it could just be like we were extraordinarily unlucky. And when Fermilab increases their statistics, their data point's going to kind of wander over here. Or it could be that there's new particles running in the loop that contribute to the muon G minus 2.
Or it could be that our theoretical calculation is wrong. And here, it's the theoretical calculation that seems like the dicier one. And in fact, around the same time, the first results from lattice calculations of contributions of this so-called hadronic vacuum polarization came out with error bars that have something to say. So previous lattice calculations had such large error bars that, yeah, you couldn't really.
When we talk about standard model prediction for G minus 2, are we using, what numbers are we using? The ones, like the previous ones, let's say, the ones predicted by the theory or the ones measured? For example, I suppose the W mass has almost no effect because it's too large, but W mass are we using to predict?
That's an interesting question. So you're using the original. So basically these calculations are done with the version of the electroweak precision fits that the that agree. So in that case, it doesn't really matter whether you're using the fit values or, yeah. So you're right. And there's actually an interesting connection to precision electroweak involving this that I'll mention in a moment. So this is the first higher precision lattice QCD result. And you can see it's kind of in the middle and closer to the experimental result. So if we take at face value that lattice calculation, now we only have a 1.5 sigma discrepancy instead of a 4.2 sigma discrepancy. But it, like I said, this is the opposite of the W mass anomaly, that then now we have a tension between, you know, if the lattice is actually living over here somewhere, then why does it not agree with these methods that are based on tried and true, you know, properties of QFT? So, you know, there, again, it could be that this lattice calculation is wrong. I am not an expert in this, so everything I've heard about this is kind of from other people who know better. But, you know, there are other lattice groups that are trying to replicate the calculation and don't have the full result. But in some limits where they expect to overlap, they kind of agree with this BMW lattice result. So it's all a little bit murky. So if the standard model turns, if you know this is a standard model prediction and we're agreeing in terms of the experiment, that now introduces a new question of why did the other method that we use get it wrong? And again, it could just be that like the standard model prediction is here and we were kind of two sigma off this way and two sigma off that way, and that's just life. But if there's really a discrepancy, then maybe that's saying that there's a problem with our extraction, for instance, of the hadronic cross sections and rates involving low energy electron positron scattering, which is possible. But that itself is a problem because that's an input to the electroweak precision fits. And it turns out that if you just say, well, let's muck around with the cross sections so that I can kind of move this over here, then that would be ruled out by the electroweak precision fits. So there seems to be something that's not quite right here. So maybe there's a mistake in some of the calculations. Maybe there's some new, so some people tried to say, well, maybe there's new physics in the hadronic sector, so it's not in the muon G minus 2, but it's influencing these. Those also appear ruled out. Yeah?
Can you repeat again what's the largest uncertainty for the standard model prediction?
So largest uncertainty is the contribution from this diagram, where I have the photon here has hadrons running in the loop. And that's because at low energies, you can imagine there's like pions and kaons and etas and all this kind of stuff, and we don't know how to calculate all of those things. At higher masses, we can just put in QQ bar, and then that's well understood. Pardon me? It's going into the non-perturbative regime, and so that's why the goal is to extract that information directly from data. So it's kind of like when Manuel was talking about PDFs, right? I can't calculate from first principles what the PDF is, but I can do scattering measurements that allow me to extract it. So the idea behind the standard model prediction is to say, let's look at scattering data involving photons and hadrons in the 100 MeV range, and that will tell me quantitatively what's going on. So I don't need to predict it. It's just, it's there. So that's why, you know, we say it's a standard model theory prediction, but that theory is using data, right? And so if you, it's not just, oh, well, maybe your theory is wrong, because then, well, what about this data? And if we're using things like unitarity, you know, that's not something we want to give up. So maybe there's some subtle effect that people have missed, or, you know, who knows. To further throw a wrench into it, earlier this year, an experiment called CMD3, which is a low energy electron positron collider, which measures some of these E plus E minus to hadron cross sections, came out with a new result that appears to be significantly different from the other experiments that were measuring the parameters that were input to muon g minus 2. This shows the kind of ratio of the extracted form factor, which is related to that blob. So the kind of best measurement, one of the best measurements up to this point is from the Babar experiment. And I guess, the interest of full disclosure, I'm a member of the Babar experiment, although I've not worked on this analysis. It's not my area of expertise. But you can see that, like, Babar, which is this gray curve, is kind of systematically low compared to this line, which is what CMD2 or CMD3 extracts. So CMD3 both seems inconsistent with the earlier version of their experiment and with the other ones. And this would shift the muon g minus 2 prediction closer to the standard model. Of course, this came out after the muon g minus 2 measurement. So no one really knows what to make of all this. So it's kind of a mess at the moment. But the mess is not in the measurement of muon g minus 2, as far as we can tell. The mess is in how you come up with what the standard model is predicting. So I think it's unclear how this is all going to work out. If you're a pessimist like I am, then you might say, well, the fact that there is questions is really, maybe it means that it's not new physics, but it's not clear how actually you would resolve all of this without having new physics somewhere or some like major issue that's been overlooked. Any questions about this before we leave this aside? And I should say that this also is very easy to explain in a new physics context. Basically, if you add anything that interacts with muons, that can contribute to the muon g minus 2. So new forces, new scalars, that sort of thing. Yeah.
How reliable are our computation of uncertainties? Is that can also...
Yeah, so I mean, in principle, the uncertainties are being propagated from, you know, these measurements to this error bar. But, you know, as with all theory calculations, the uncertainties... So there's kind of real experimental uncertainty that feeds into that. But then there's also the usual theory uncertainty of, like, if I made an assumption and that assumption doesn't quite hold, I can estimate the effect, but it's not going to be like, you know, a Poisson distribution or something, right? Like, there is a real value to the stuff that I'm dropping. So maybe that's it. But, you know, people have been scrutinizing this discrepancy for 20 plus years, right? So nothing obvious has popped out of what's wrong with the existing method. So that's part of where the confusion lies, is that you have this new method. So then people might say, well, I don't really want to trust the new thing because it disagrees with my old thing, but the new thing agrees with the standard model. So that, you know, that could potentially offer the resolution to this. You know, we're also skeptical of new physics. So it's kind of a mess, but it's exciting. And of course, on the experiment side, muon g minus 2 continues to run, so that error bar will considerably shrink. So, you know, we'll soon be able to, at least on the experiment side, either get 5 sigma away from the green one, see, you know, because of course, you know, it could be that the true experiment result is like over here, but it could also be over here, right? And then that might not even be consistent with the lattice calculation. So that's all to be determined. Okay. The last thing that I want to mention is this was kind of a hot topic around the time of the discovery of the Higgs boson, and it's not a sign for new physics in the traditional sense of, like, you do a calculation and you see a discrepancy between experiment and theory, but it's a purely theoretical calculation. But, you know, now the standard model is complete. We have estimates for all of the parameters in the standard model. And so then we can do calculations of things like the running of the coupling constants under renormalization group evolution. So here this is showing the evolution of these couplings as a function of the scale parameter and the value of that coupling. So alpha 1, alpha 2, and alpha 3 are the three gauge couplings. You have a top Yukawa coupling. Excuse me. And then you have this Higgs quartic coupling, okay, which is basically the lambda. This is, you know, alpha lambda, so presumably lambda squared over 4 pi or something. The major uncertainty on the evolution of these couplings is from the uncertainty on the top quark mass. So Manmala kind of hinted that, or said pretty explicitly, it's really hard to measure the top quark mass. So there's relatively large uncertainties on that, and that gives you this band. So what happens here? Well, this is actually the absolute value. So it crosses sign here. And that seems bad, because if I have a quartic thing that it has a negative value, then at large values of the field, you know, I'm going to have something that goes like this. And that seems bad from the point of view of like a theory that makes sense, because as I roll down here, I can just gain energy in perpetuity. And that seems unphysical. So normally we put some, there needs to be some kind of lower bound on your potential energy in order to have some sensible thing. Yes?
And those energies, can't we have temperature that helps us with that?
And you have temperature that helps you with that. So there's a few things you could say. So I think, so for example, during inflation, you may not have a temperature, but you have a Hubble parameter. So like there are reasons why the thermal corrections might not save you, for instance, from during inflation. So I should say that we're kind of in some situation where there's like that, right? So we're living here. I mean, actually we're offset by distance V, okay? And then at some distance here, this is like 10 to the 10 GeV, it goes off. So, you know, because there are periods of the expansion history that are not thermally dominated, then that doesn't necessarily save you. You can also worry about like tunneling through here now, right? So that's also a concern. But you're right that you need to know what the theory is at this scale in order to reliably compute those temperature-dependent and medium-dependent corrections. So it seems like in the standard model, we don't have that, okay? Now, whether this runs to zero below the Planck scale. So here's the Planck scale where we expect some theory of quantum gravity to kind of come in and save us from all of the things we don't like. So if we can kind of postpone this to here, then maybe we don't worry too much because, you know, I don't really trust my non-gravitational theory calculation above that scale. So what this would suggest is that, and I guess what I should say before I say talk about the new physics interpretation is that if the top mass were 3 sigma away from its measured value, then you would not run negative. Okay, so 3 sigma, that's not a huge thing. That's not, you know, we wouldn't call this a discovery of new physics, right? So within a reasonable range, you can postpone this running because it's logarithmic, so relatively small shifts can have a dramatic change on the behavior. But if we take this at face value, this would suggest that there needs to be some new particles that come in somewhere between us, or I guess, you know, the electroweak scale and 10 to the 10 GeV, that would then feed into the renormalization group evolution and deflect this away from an unphysical solution. Or maybe the standard model is an effective field theory and there's extra terms at these scales that stabilize you. Or maybe everything is composite, and you know, so there's all sorts of things, but it would basically say that the cutoff of my theory would have to be like here instead of there. So this is kind of interest. It's not something that we can necessarily directly test because we don't really have any experiments that will be directly getting at 10 to the 10 GeV. But it's still kind of a thing to put in the back of your mind of like maybe somewhere in there has to be something new. There are some other reasons why this scale might be interesting, like there are various things that you need, like for instance to give neutrinos mass, we'll talk about that, that could be coming in and rescuing you and so on. But if you are putting stuff in that's heavy, this also can induce what's called a naturalness problem, and probably the person who's talking about beyond standard model physics will talk about naturalness. So, yes.
And what kind of particle can save us?
Pretty much anything. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. You know, couplings generally like to get stronger at higher energies. So usually you have this problem of you hit a Landau pole. Okay. So this is an unusual situation. Okay, because of the relative signs of top quark, Gauge boson, etc. So it's really not hard to do that. Yeah. But you know, for a while it was really interesting because when the Higgs boson was first discovered, the uncertainty in the mass was significantly larger, like a GeV or so. And then you could really span the like, you know, this goes all the way out here to there being kind of a real crisis. And so it's interesting that the improvements in the measurements have come so much that like, apparently the uncertainty from the Higgs boson mass is completely negligible in this now. It's entirely due to the top quark mass. Any other questions about this? Okay. So now I'm going to move on to the last topic, which we'll have about an hour to spend on, and that's going to be neutrinos and using neutrinos as a way of kind of getting an entry into the world of flavor, because flavor is another way that precision measurements really matter beyond just the gauge structure. Okay, and just a couple of slides to show the evidence for interesting physics neutrino sectors. The thing that we're really interested in is this phenomenon of neutrino oscillation, that I make neutrinos of a particular type, and then they seem to change into another type after some finite distance, like a long distance. So this is one of the results from SuperK that led to the Nobel Prize and the discovery of neutrino oscillations. And it basically comes to the fact that in the atmosphere, we've heard about cosmic rays. Cosmic rays hit the atmosphere, producing pions. These pions predominantly 10,000 to 1 decay to muons instead of electrons. So we produce a whole bunch of muon neutrinos. And the atmosphere surrounds the Earth, thankfully. So we have neutrinos that are kind of coming from all directions. And because neutrinos don't interact very much, they fly through the Earth. So what we can do is look at kind of neutrinos that are coming. If I have a detector here, there's neutrinos that are coming from this very thin part. They just come through the atmosphere, order tens of kilometers. And then we have stuff from the other side, which has gone thousands of kilometers. And what we notice is that we see many, many more muon neutrinos at the short path than the long path. So it seems like these muon neutrinos are disappearing and turning into something else. If you look at the electron neutrinos, nothing happens to them. So you can conclude that these muon neutrinos are turning into tau neutrinos. And this is the phenomenon of neutrino oscillations. And importantly, it's only happening over certain distances, that if you look at shorter distances, we don't see this disappearance effect. Then we look at longer distances, we do. So that's one of the things that we need to unpack and explore. The reason why it's connected to flavor is precisely this fact that one flavor of neutrino is turning into another flavor of neutrino. We can also, for instance, see neutrino oscillations from nuclear reactors. So for instance, nuclear processes are much lower in energy, and the only neutrinos you make are electron neutrinos and electron antineutrinos. And so you can look at the flux of, for instance, electron neutrinos. And this is some ratio that we'll see is related to the oscillation parameter. And you can see the wiggles. You can actually see that as you change the effective distance, that the probability of seeing these electron neutrinos goes up and down, okay? So that there's some time dependence in these interactions. Yeah?
I'm not sure, but isn't it the idea that all of the three flavors oscillate? Mm-hmm. Because you just said nothing happens to the electron neutrinos on the side.
That's over those distance scales and on those probability scales. So basically what this means, so that predominantly over those lengths, it's muon and tau that are oscillating to one another. And then there's going to be some correction from the fact that the electrons are coming in. But
it would take more.
Yeah, and it's a rarer thing. Like the coefficient in front of that is a small number. So you need to make really precise measurements in order to extract that.
Sorry, on this plot, is the dashed line some sort of theory prediction?
Yes. So basically what you can do is take... So the challenge with reactor neutrinos is that nuclear reactors are kind of a mess. So you produce a whole bunch of isotopes, and you don't necessarily want to go into your reactor and mess around with them. So you have some prediction of that, and then you can use that to extrapolate what you expect the flux to be. Okay, so I will ask to have the screen up, and then we can work through some of the physics to hopefully explain these things.
How do you rule out the idea that the neutrino can decay to another neutrino oscillation?
Sorry, can you say that a bit? Maybe we'll wait for this to finish going up. Sorry, can you say that again?
Did you rule out the idea that neutrino decaying to another neutrino?
How do you rule out that idea?
The tau is turning into muon neutrino, right? Decaying into, then I can have the five different
forms. That is true. So, at this point, we have enough data from all of the different flavors turning into the other flavors that I don't think you can do that in a simple decay scenario. So this is an explanation, for instance, for some of these other anomalies that don't seem to fit the oscillation patterns. But yeah, I Yeah, and for the original measurement, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, so there's also the correlation with the discovery of solar neutrino oscillations. So again, I think that there are differences in terms of how do you... Like, the other thing if with decays, for example, is that if you wait long enough, all of a certain thing will have decayed. But here, what you see is you don't asymptote to zero. You asymptote to something where I'm averaging sine squared theta, you know, sine squared, you know, L, essentially, to 1/2, right? So in that context, I think when you look on multiple scales, if it was a decay, you'd just see it damping away. Yeah. This is a good question, though. And like I said, when you're only seeing this in one measurement, then you might worry because I'm like measuring it on one baseline. And so maybe I was kind of unlucky and this experiment is tuned to the decay length of that particle. Okay. So, let's see what the theory has to say about neutrino flavor. So, remember that we had our mass Lagrangian for leptons. So I have, say, my like electron-Yukawa coupling, had some Higgs. It had ER dagger L, okay, plus Hermitian conjugate. Remember this L was a neutrino and a left-handed electron. Okay, so the neutrinos are embedded in this same interaction. Now, before we did this for a single flavor, but in general, I have three flavors of leptons. So I have to put an index here. So runs over three, runs over three. And when I go into unitary gauge and you know, insert the Higgs VEV, I'm gonna get something like Y E I J V over root two or L J plus Hermitian conjugate. And so I have some mass matrix, which is a 3x3 matrix. Mij, E, which is YEIJV over a square root of 2. So for single flavor, it's easy. I only have one combination. Now I have 9 combinations of the two fields. So I have this 3x3 matrix. And when I want to go into the basis of energy eigenstates or the basis of mass eigenstates, I need to diagonalize this matrix because I want to find, you know, what are the pairs that go together, right? And it's not generically going to be in the basis that I happen to write my fields down originally.
Sorry, just to understand notation, yeah. In that case, that ER would be the same as with an overbar.
Would that be the same as with an over bar? So I'm using kind of a two component spinner notation here.
Oh. Yeah.
This would be the same as E bar left handed projector E in the four component spinner notation. Yeah. There's a gamma zero that shows up there. Okay.
So the IJs are now flavor indices?
These are now flavor indices. So I and J run over. You know, you can think of them as 1, 2, or 3, or, yeah, let's call them 1, 2, and 3. So, and we know that there are three eigenstates that we need, mass eigenstates that we need to get out of this. Okay, so I need to have a 3x3 matrix. So if you reach back into the murky recess of your math education, you may have learned about something called singular value decomposition, which is that if you have an arbitrary complex matrix, you can diagonalize it, or rather maybe factorize is a better word, that I can write ME as U dagger ME diagonal V, where U and D are unitary matrices. So this seems nice because I can now do a field redefinition. Like if I put this in, I see that I have a U dagger E dagger and a capital V L J. And so I can redefine my fields like ER goes.
U V unitary, right?
Oh yeah, thanks. U and V are unitary. And this v is different from the little v.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so then we can do the left-handed lepton goes to v left-handed lepton. Okay, so I'm just redefining my fields. And of course, the fields are some mathematical human construction. I can define them however I want. And then when after that, I'm just going to end up with a diagonal matrix ij er dagger I elj plus permission conjugate. So this is nice. Okay, so I so in this basis, my I runs over, let's say, e, mu, and tau, right? And this is how we define our what I mean by an electron is that it is in this basis, that's the electron field. So we've diagonalized our matrix and we get this. So far we're just doing mathematical manipulations on Lagrangian. We're not doing any physics, but because I found a basis like this, I know I can work in this basis and then I know things are simple. I don't think I ever said that this D was diagonal, so maybe I will write that. And you know, that what that means, of course, is that M D E I J is equal to some M E I delta I J. Any questions about this? So we often, for leptonic physics, use the charged lepton flavor basis because that's the mass basis for the particles that you actually see what masses they are in. Yeah. I mean, let's put it this way. In this basis, I have I have 9 entries in my matrix, and in this basis, I have 3. So I'm going to pick using the basis where I have to deal with 3 numbers instead of 9. Yeah.
Are we just like including like ELJ? Is that just from like the one of the doublets? From to be clear, like
I made a mistake here. Sorry, when I put in the Higgs-Vev, this should be a left-handed electron. Yeah, because because remember my Higgs vacuum excitation value is 1/√2 0 V. Okay, so when I put in this VEV, it picks out the EL component.
Okay. So what's happening to the top line on the top board and the bottom? And the bottom is just the VEV.
So we've inserted the VEV here, exactly. Yeah. Because when it's just couplings, you're like, why do I need to work in a diagonal basis, right? I mean, it might be convenient for some calculations, but once I say that this is the mass matrix and I want to find my energy eigenstates, that's kind of what we always want to do. Okay. Okay, so all of our interactions, but in particular, the charge current interactions stay the same. Okay, for instance, if I have some, you know, nu bar L gamma mu W mu plus left-handed electron, maybe I'll just write it as EL minus. Okay. Because I'm transforming both components of this doublet, I basically get like a V dagger and a V. And because these are unitary matrices, that V dagger V gives me 1. So this just maps to the same thing. So basically what that tells me is that my change of basis doesn't actually change any of my other interactions, right? Which is nice. So this is a good thing to do. I don't end up with any off-diagonal elements. So what this tells me is that my flavor states are mass eigenstates. And by flavor states, what I mean is that if I go to Atlas and I measure a W plus goes to mu plus and something, that this new mu is the same thing that shows up in this diagonal form of the mass spaces. So these are our mass eigenstates, and therefore they're energy eigenstates. And even my sophomores can tell you that energy eigenstates are stationary states. They don't change as a function of time. when I make, so in this picture where I have given mass to the charged leptons, but I have not given mass to the neutrinos, the neutrinos are stationary states. And this is in direct contradiction with neutrino oscillation experiments. So this, this disagrees with the results of that we just saw, that there seems to be this time dependence, right, which is really crucial. So this tells us that,
we've put the leptons as, sorry, the electron gluons and tauons as energy eigenstates.
Yeah.
Why does this imply that so are the neutrinos?
What's the neutrino mass here?
Well, here there's not.
There's not, yeah. So, yeah.
There.
Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah. So the neutrinos are massless, and that contradicts neutrino oscillation experiments. So that's kind of one of the things we're trying to build towards, and that I was about to say, is that this tells us neutrinos have to have a mass, because if the neutrinos don't have a mass, then you would predict that they would not oscillate. One way you could phrase this is that in order to have any time-dependent phenomena in quantum mechanics, you need to produce a state that's a superposition of different energy eigenstates. But if the neutrinos are all massless, there's no way that based on their mass I can distinguish them. So the only way I can distinguish them is from the flavor state of the associated lepton. And then once I've done that, there's nothing that distinguishes them, so I can always just say, well, I've created this one energy eigenstate. So I basically can't get neutrino oscillations in the minimal standard model that we wrote down. So what we actually want is something like this. Where an electron neutrino is a linear combination of a bunch of different mass eigenstates. And just to establish a bit of convention, so these nu1, nu2, nu3 are the mass eigenstates. Okay, and they are defined so that nu1 has the most overlap with the electron neutrino, and then nu3 has the least. So basically, I'm kind of ordering my neutrino masses based on how much does it share with the electron neutrino. Because otherwise, I can label them however I want to. This is just a convention. And that then it means that if, say, my psi at time 0 is nu e, then my psi at some time t is going to be UE1 e to the minus I energy 1t plus blah, blah, blah. And then to get oscillations means that I need to at least have some set of energies that are not the same. Yes?
This fixing of the most overlap at least is what fixes the sine of delta m to 1 squared.
It does not. The solar neutrino, yeah. So we are not saying anything that nu1 is lighter than nu2, and nu2 is lighter than nu3. All we're saying, and that's an important distinction, because in order to define a sign for the mass squared splittings, I need to tell you what it means to have m1 and m2. Yes.
So I guess it would just be that you're saying that the absolute value of UE1 is greater than
or equal. Right. Yeah. So I can kind of order these hierarchically. Okay, so we want this, but we don't have this in the kind of minimal implementation of the standard model. So we now need to add something. So let's now look at the case of a non-zero neutrino mass. For the other standard model particles, how did we give them a mass? Like, what was the thing that we needed to give them a mass? How does that come about? A Higgs coupling. What does the Higgs coupling couple? What does it connect?
Left hand and the right hand.
left handed and right handed, right? So remember, in order to have a mass, I need to have a left handed particle and a right handed particle. So you might say, oh, well, the neutrino is neutral, so why don't I connect it to its own antiparticle? That doesn't work because in the standard model, the neutrino carries hypercharge and SU2 gauge charge, right? So the neutrino, even though it doesn't carry electric charge, does carry other standard model charges. And if I were to put in a neutrino mass by hand, it would break gauge invariance just like putting an electron mass would by hand. Okay. But what we can do is add a right-handed neutrino. This is usually called N sub R. And so I basically want is some mass Lagrangian for my neutrino, which is going to be like minus, I just want to make sure I'm using consistent notation here, F, okay, HNR dagger L plus Hermitian conjugate. And so remember last time when we were talking about the up quarks, giving them a mass, we had to combine two doublets together, and so we formed this anti-symmetric combination that was like, so in this case, the anti-symmetric combination would be like H plus E minus minus H zero nu is the way I can make an anti-symmetric combination of these two doublets. We often use the shorthand notation of epsilon H, okay? And the reason for this is that if I write this in index notation, and this is the Levi-Civita symbol, I can write this combination like this. So this takes the anti-symmetric product of those two doublets. So we'll write this. If you don't really care about that, it's just this is H and not H star. Like, that's the important thing. It was H star that showed up there. It's H that shows up here.
Mm-hmm. Is that analogous to the H tile?
Yeah, yeah. It's the same as the H tilde, yeah. Yeah. So sometimes this is called H tilde. There's a few equivalent notations that people use. Yeah. The important thing is that when I take this combination and I put a VeV on the neutral Higgs, it picks out the neutrino. It doesn't pick. So when I took the other combination, the VeV picks up the charged lepton. But now the VeV picks out the neutrino to give a mass to. Okay. So this is then going to become minus FV over root 2 NR dagger nu L plus Hermitian conjugate. So we've just added a mass, okay, and this is a Dirac mass, just like for the electron. Yeah.
Why does it have to couple to the Higgs? Couldn't we just give it a mass? There's no problem like with a spin one.
So the problem comes with, if I just give it a mass and I break gauge invariance, I don't conserve the standard model gauge charges. And because, for instance, if I have, so the neutrino is embedded in the L doublet. The only way I can give a field on its own a mass is by having it mix with its antiparticle, okay? But the L doublet has hypercharge minus a half, and L bar has hypercharge plus a half. So if I try to give a Majorana a mass to that, then I break hypercharge. Then when I couple that to the gauge field, I reintroduce all of my problems. So you're right that in principle, fermion masses don't have the same problem. But if they couple to gauge fields, then they do if they don't conserve the current. OK, so this story is exactly the same as that story. It's exactly the same as the up quark and down quark masses. And so, you know, whether neutrino masses are beyond the standard model is kind of a question of debate, because some people would be like, I don't know, you just add a right-handed neutrino just like you add everything else, and that seems pretty standard model. Like, as we'll see, it's not so simple, okay, that there are other things that can come into play here. But we can also do the similar thing where I can add indices. Again, I just want to make sure I'm using consistent notation. Where did my thing go here? Yeah. So, I mean, usually we put like an alpha, like we use Greek letters for the standard model leptons and Latin letters for the right-handed neutrinos. So I have alpha going from 1 to 3 because these are standard model. My I actually don't know how many I have, but I have a number, when you do the singular value decomposition, I have a number of mass eigenstates equal to the number of right-handed neutrinos. So if I only want one of my neutrinos, standard model neutrinos, to get a mass, then I can get away with one. Okay. If I want two of my standard model neutrinos to have a mass, I need to give two. It turns out that there are two different oscillation lengths that we see, and so we need at least two of the standard model neutrinos to have a mass, but we don't necessarily need all three of them to have a mass. So we actually don't know how many right-handed neutrinos are. There might be two, there might be three, there might be more, and then only some subset of them would be participating in this interaction when we move into the diagonal basis. What are the standard model gauge charges of N? Any ideas? So let's remind ourselves, what's the standard model gauge charge of the Higgs field? What's the hypercharge of the Higgs field?
1/2.
1/2, yeah, 1/2, okay. And what's, it's an SU2 doublet, okay, so this is 2.5. This is also a doublet. Hypercharge of the charged electron is, it's the average of the charges of the electrocharges of the components, so that's going to be, well, so let's see. So the doublet has a neutrino in the top and an electron in the bottom, so I take the average, I get -1/2, right? Okay. So this HL combination is neutral under the standard model. So this NR has no standard model gauge charge.
So that would explain why we didn't detect anything, because they don't couple to it.
They don't couple directly. They only couple from the fact that they're giving a mass to the standard model neutrinos, and the mass is really small. So that already it's like, you know, we're struggling to see that it has a mass. So a natural question that we could have is like, okay, let's estimate F. Okay. So the masses of the standard model neutrinos are about 0.1 electron volts. Okay. They could be a bit bigger, but cosmological constraints and combination of oscillation things kind of tend to push us towards that mass scale. So F is going to be, you know, root 2 m nu over the standard model VEV. So this Yukawa coupling is going to be about 5 times 10 to the minus 13. How do you feel about that? This is a little small. What's, okay, the next smallest in the standard model, the next smallest Yukawa coupling is the electron Yukawa, which is about 10 to the minus 6. Okay, and then they're fairly regularly spaced. They're like the muon is about 10 to the minus 4, the charm quark's about 10 to the minus 2, you know, and then you go from there. So is it a problem to have Yukawa coupling 5 times 10 to the minus 13? I don't know. Like, it's a parameter, that's what we measure it to be. But a lot of people don't like the fact that there seems to be this really big gap, right? We kind of have a bunch of Yukawa couplings that are all 10 to the minus 6, and most of them significantly larger. And then you kind of have this vast empty space, and then you have a bunch of neutrinos that are so much lighter than everything else. And at least two of them are comparable in mass, so it seems like there's some structure there, right? That there might be some reason. There's a reason. These are lighter than the other particles. But in this minimal framework, this is just a question of the values of the parameters, and we don't have any explanation for that. So this is totally self-consistent, but it seems maybe like something that people don't like very much. Yeah?
At this level of smallness, how can one loop corrections affect neutrino masses?
That's a great question. So all fermions have this property called chiral symmetry, that in the limit where you take the mass to zero, the left and right-handed components completely separate out. Okay, and what the implications of that are is that if I don't have the field content to generate the neutrino mass, and the neutrino mass, it comes entirely from this coupling, none of the other couplings in the theory will give me a neutrino mass. So that means that all of my radiative corrections will first have a F, then standard model couplings multiplying that, so my why quantum corrections will not generate a large one. And this is what we mean by naturalness. Like for the neutrino, if I make it small, it might be a bit gross that I made it a bit small, but then once I put it there, it stays small. Okay? That's different from the Higgs mass parameter, where I kind of make it small and then corrections pull it back up. And I make it small again and quantum corrections pull it up. Okay? But that only happens for spin zero particles. For spin one particles, there's a similar story where gauge invariance stops. So we know that spin one particles can have a gauge invariance, and that means that masses only originate either from Higgs or from terms that break the gauge symmetry. Okay, so what we now want to do is look at this flavor diagonalization picture and see what changes. So I'll leave this up here. None of the stuff on this board is modified at all because we haven't done anything to the charged leptons. Oh God, this is still here from yesterday. Okay. We get a nice review of that. Oh, and all of my brushes are up there as well. Okay, so we're still going to work in the basis of the diagonal charged masses. Okay. Where on earth is my thing gone? Okay. So we now need to diagonalize what we call the Dirac mass. Okay. Oh, this is annoying. I realize that this D for diagonal is also a D for Dirac. Okay, so let's call this a little d. Okay. Our Dirac mass matrix, which is MD, okay, which is FV over root 2. So this is the Dirac mass, neutrino mass matrix. Okay, so we can do this singular value decomposition again. Okay. It's exactly the same. But here I rotated the whole doublet. But now I don't want to rotate the charged lepton because my charged leptons are knights. Okay. So I'm going to do the same thing. So I'm going to have my right-handed neutrinos transform according to the unitary matrix associated with, so this is unitary matrix associated with the new mass singular value decomposition. And I'm going to have my new left go like V prime new left. And that's going to diagonalize the Dirac mass matrix. Okay. So we're just finding the basis of energy eigenstates now for that. So if I close my eyes and pretend that the charged leptons are there, just do it again.
Does this not break the doublet structure?
Yes, but we've already put in a Higgs VEV, so that's fine. So I mean, these masses wouldn't, like these wouldn't be energy eigenstates if I had not put the VEV in. That's maybe one way of putting it. Okay, so what are the implications of this? So let's look at the W coupling. So I have nu left bar, gamma mu W mu plus EL minus. Now I'm rotating the neutrino field, but not the charged lepton field. So this is going to become nu L bar V prime gamma mu W mu plus EL minus. Or in other words, if I put the flavor indices in, that unitary matrix associated with the singular value decomposition actually shows up in my W interaction. Okay? And that's because the W couples the neutrinos to the charged leptons. I can always choose to diagonalize one of them. So you know, we diagonalize the charged leptons. But then when I perform the next rotation on this neutrino field, this interaction is no longer diagonal. Okay. So this means that I can have, for instance, a W that decays to, say, a mu plus and some linear combination of nu 1, nu 2, nu 3. Right? This is no longer diagonal, where these are the mass eigenstates of the neutrino. this matrix, or rather the dagger of this, is defined as something called the PM&S matrix, okay, which tells us about the misalignment between, you know, if I tag my neutrino by the lepton that it's produced with, or I specify my neutrino in terms of the energy eigenstates. Okay. So this U being not the identity matrix is exactly what we need for neutrino oscillations. What I need is that I make a linear combination of the mass eigenstates, and we've seen that that does show up here. Okay. So we've seen that giving a mass influences the flavor structure such that we can expect to see neutrino oscillations.
Could we somehow do the whole thing in reverse and observe lepton, like muon electron oscillation?
That is a great question. So in principle, you could, except for the fact that the masses are really large for the muon electron, so their oscillation scale is really short. So what's typically going to happen is that you're going to enter the rapid oscillation phase, they decohere, and you don't see the quantum correlations. So the reason why this kind of makes sense and the reverse doesn't is because, you know, we saw Manuel was like, there's the muon in my detector. I've like measured that mass eigenstate. That decoheres me into this combination as opposed to the other one. But you're right that it's agnostic in terms of how we're producing it. Yeah.
So is that the analog of the lepton analog of the CKM matrix?
Absolutely. Yeah. So that is a great observation, which is that there's nothing about this that's special for neutrinos because the quarks are exactly the same. I give mass to the up quarks, I give mass to the down quarks. I first diagonalize, say, the up quark mass matrix. Then when I try to diagonalize the down quark mass matrix, I get this extra unitary matrix factor. So this is same, or maybe I should say analog of the CKM matrix for quarks. So then you might ask, well, why don't we see quark oscillations? And it's for this exact reason that I just mentioned, which is that the mass splitting between the quarks is quite large. Okay, and so we measure the quark mass eigenstates. So they tend to decohere into that basis because there's rapid oscillations, and then I measure in the mass basis. I measure my neutrinos in the interaction basis. When I take this neutrino packet and I smash it into something, what I see is, oh, an electron came out, or oh, a muon came out. So neutrinos are different because we measure them in their flavor basis. We don't measure them in the mass basis because the masses are so tiny. For every other particle in the standard model, we measure it in the mass basis. So that's why we get neutrino oscillations and not oscillations among the quarks in the CKM matrix. And by quark oscillations, I mean like I don't like have a top bottom and then the bottom oscillates into like a strange quark, right? What I have is some incoherent sum of there's some probability of making a top and a bottom and what's some probability of making a top and a strange. So it's all the fun quantum mechanics that get swept under the rug actually when we do normal quantum field theory. You know, you pick a basis and you do this thing, but it's actually much more subtle. When you want to self-consistently take into these effects into account in quantum field theory, you need to be a little bit careful. Yeah.
Another difference could be, correct me, that the CKM is relating processes, like interactions,
yes,
their space, let's say, and the PM&S is also related to propagation. Because we're talking about mass bases. The other cases, we're comparing like the strong states and weak states.
So what you're saying is correct. So one thing we should always say is that quantum mechanics should be basis independent. I should be able to get the same answer whether I work in this basis or that basis. The reason why for quarks, we usually, so for quarks, we don't do this. For quarks, we do this or this. And that's because of the fact that there's rapid oscillation and decoherence that leads to this looking as if that these are distinguishable states, right? So at the moment of creation, actually these two states, you know, this set and this set are the same. They both propagate, but because of the differences in the mass structure as well as the difference in the way we measure them, we're kind of asking different questions about what part of the evolution I care about. And when I'm performing a measurement in the mass basis, I actually don't care about the time evolution phase at all because the time evolution phase doesn't affect the coefficient in front of that mass eigenstate. But if I'm doing a measurement in the flavor basis, then these relative coefficients all change, and then when I go back into the flavor basis, it's possible that this has turned into a new E or a new tau. Okay. So mathematically, it's literally identical. Mm-hmm.
Could you explain that again, what it means to make a measurement in the flavor basis instead of the mass basis?
Yeah, so in quantum mechanics, we always need to ask, okay, like, being very crude here, and there's probably like, you know, spears that will come out of the wall if I say this at perimeter, but if you think it, it's, you know, I collapse my wave function by performing a measurement, which wave function I collapse into depends on how I perform the measurement. So what I mean by measuring the neutrino in the flavor basis is that I have a beam of neutrinos, it hits a tank of stuff. If it undergoes a charge current scattering, it might make a muon. And then I'd say, oh, that was a muon neutrino because I made a muon. Or I might make a tau, and then I say that was a tau neutrino. I don't measure the neutrino itself. But in the quark case, you can actually measure this. So for, I mean, we learned about like B-jet tagging, right? Like bottom quarks, they hadronize differently, they decay on different time scales. So for this, I'm actually measuring, was that a B quark or a strange quark? Not, oh, I measured the top quark and I'm gonna infer that there was a B there. It's so foreign to us that we would never even think of doing it that way. But it, you know, what we're seeing is that in neutrino physics, we're so used to a certain limit that you just do a certain set of procedures. And in quark physics, you're in a different limit and you do a different set of procedures. But you can imagine a situation where you just made the mass structure of the quarks look like neutrinos and vice versa, and then you would just switch what you do. It's not a magical thing. We're implicitly doing a bunch of quantum info-y stuff here. Okay. So this is great. We recover the property of neutrino oscillations, at least in principle, you can see that. The other thing that I want to mention is that you generate these off-diagonal elements in the charge current, but a really important feature of the standard model is that you don't generate them in the neutral current. Okay? So if I do the same thing for, say, a Z boson coupling, you know, I basically have some nu bar L, gamma mu, z mu, nu L. This nu L bar picks up a V prime dagger. This nu L picks up a V prime, where now I'm talking about this unitary matrix. It gets mapped back to the same thing. So flavor conserved in neutral currents. Okay. Interactions. So this means that the standard model forbids processes like mu decaying to E and a photon. Okay. And I should say at tree level. It actually forbids that overall. But it also, at tree level, you don't get things like top to CZ and stuff like that. Okay. These vertices don't show up at tree level. You have to compute radiative corrections to that. So this is an important component of the flavor structure standard model, that we see flavor changing only through the W boson interactions, not through the Z boson interactions. And that means that, for instance, I can have bottom decay to charm easily, but bottom decaying to strange does not happen easily. You know, similarly, I don't have like H to E mu or H to you know, B bar S. Like these are all not happening. And it's because the unitarity of these, and you know, part of the kind of story of the discovery of the standard model was that they didn't see flavor changing neutral current interactions, and that inspired the, you know, the gym mechanism people to say, well, maybe there's this fourth quark that's charm quark. And once I introduce that charm quark, I can construct a unitary matrix and make sure that these kinds of interactions turn off. And then lo and behold, they discover the charm quark. How do they discover the charm quark? Does anyone remember what particle you used to discover the charm quark? It's the J psi, yeah. The reason why I brought it up is that I was asking you yesterday and you didn't remember the J psi. So like, it's the J psi, it keeps coming up. But yes, so show up in W's, don't show up in Z's. That's a really important thing. Did I lose my brush again? Okay. So the last thing we want to do is count parameters and construct what these unitary matrices look like. Okay, so U, PM, and S is a 3x3 unitary matrix has complex entries. So you start with 2 times 9, which are 18 real parameters, okay, for the real and imaginary parts of each of the 9 entries in my 3x3 matrix. Okay. Then I impose my unitarity condition, okay, which is that the dot product of a row and column with itself is 1, and with another one it's 0. So imposing unitarity reduces me to 9. And you can do this in general, you know, n by n, but we'll just do it for 3. If these parameters were real, so I remove the complex phases, what I have is a 3x3 rotation matrix, and that has 3 angles in it, okay? So if you think back to classical mechanics, you have these Euler angles. So Euler angles are the way that you can take a vector pointing, say, in the z direction and rotate it to any point through a combination of 3 rotations. So this consists of 3 angles, and then by extension, 6 phases, okay? Because the other 9 have to be that. But phases are tricky in quantum mechanics. As, you know, we know that certain things are invariant under rephasing. Okay. And in particular, all of our diagonalization stuff that we've been doing has all been about changing one flavor into another, but it's not been about adjusting the phases in my matrix. So I can play these games where I can be like, well, let me rotate my left-handed electron. I don't change the flavor indices, I just rephase one of them. Okay? And then I absorb that phase in the right-handed lepton, so it doesn't show up anywhere, it just is gone from my theory. So I can actually rotate away 5 of the phases. And the reason why it's 5 is that, let's say I rotate left-handed electron, left-handed muon, left-handed tau, left-handed electron neutrino, left-handed muon neutrino. Now, if I also rotated the left-handed tau neutrino, I would have rephased everything, but my Lagrangian is invariant under rephasing literally everything, so that can't actually change the coupling. And so what we can do is basically rephase 5 of the 6 lepton fields that are in there and get rid of 5 of the 6 phases, and we are left with 1 phase. So we have 3 mixing angles and 1 phase. If you did this with 2 neutrinos or 2 quark generations, you would get 1 mixing angle and 0 phases. And this was actually used to predict the existence of the third generation. So phases and couplings lead to a phenomenon of CP violation, distinguishing matter-antimatter rates. And CP violation had been observed in the kaon system. So Kobayashi and Maskawa of CKM, the K and M, they were like, huh, you don't get a complex phase in, you know, the Kabibo matrix, but if you just add an extra entry, then you get one. And then lo and behold, they discovered the bottom quark, okay, and the rest is history. So there seems to be this interesting, you know, this doesn't explain why we have 3 generations, but it says we get much richer phenomena with 3 generations than we would have had if we only had 2 generations. Turning that into like a concrete statement about the world is not really something you can do, but it's fun to think about in terms of thinking about the number of generations. So the usual parameterization, I will just quickly write it out. You can look this up everywhere, but I think it's helpful to define what some of the parameters are, because you sometimes see these and you'll probably be hearing about them in your underground or accelerator experiment session. So you can basically parameterize this as 3 mixing angles where, like, this means cosine theta 2, 3. So there's going to be a 1, 3. Then there's going to be a 1, 2. Okay. And that's the most general structure you can get for either the PMNS matrix or the CKM matrix. And of course, there are various ways you can reparameterize these. So you might see different, there's the Wolfenstein parameterization and other things that you might have seen. Oh, this should be a 1 here. And these are all parameters that you can measure. So, you know, theta 1, 2 is about 34 degrees, theta 2, 3 is about 45 degrees, theta 1, 3 about 8.5 degrees. Delta, we actually don't know. If you look at the 3 sigma interval, it's quite large. Okay. So one of the open questions is, what is this? Because if it's zero, then actually we wouldn't have CP violation in the neutrino sector. So it's possible that it's there or not there. So the way these neutrino experiments go, you have a couple of different mass splittings. So it's known that the mass splitting squared of delta M31 is this. And we know the absolute value of the 2-1 squared splitting. That's because solar neutrinos go through the sun, which has a lot of stuff in it. And the, when you take into account the matter effects, it matters, the ordering of these. So these tell us something about the oscillation length. And you know, the probability of E staying as E or E going to mu involve different factors of these angles. So depending on the parameters you want, you select a particular beam. If it's nu E's, it would be a reactor. If it's nu mu's, you probably use pion decays to produce them. You set up an experiment over the length scale that captures the oscillation that you want. And then you measure, you know, I should get 1,000 muon neutrinos, and I saw 800. And I expected 0 electron neutrinos, and I saw 100. And then you fit all of this to try and extract what these parameters are. So that's kind of the essence of like the neutrino program. I think it's helpful to have seen, so because you'll see some of these parameters popping up. But what's perhaps the most interesting story is that this theta 1-3 parameter, when I was in grad school, which is not that long ago, although it's getting there, had not been measured yet. Like it could have been zero. And now it's actually the most precisely measured angle, which goes to show you some of the improvements that have come with neutrino experiments. So it's no longer true that we don't know anything about neutrinos. We actually know a lot about neutrinos, but there are some things like the CP violation. We also don't know, basically you can have two different types of mass splitting. You could have like 2, 1, and 3, or you could have 3, 2, and 1, and both of these are compatible. So this is called the neutrino mass hierarchy or mass ordering problem. So what the next generation of experiments are going to try and target the delta and to try and target the neutrino mass ordering. Okay. And that neutrino mass ordering largely comes from these medium effects. So that's one of the reasons why over these long baseline experiments, you want to shoot the neutrinos through like thousands of kilometers of rock. Because when you shoot them over thousands of kilometers of rock, you can accentuate the effects of the matter and hopefully distinguish between these different orderings of the mass eigenstates. So this gets back to the question of is one the lightest? No, one is the most electron neutrino-like, and 3 is the least. So it's kind of a whirlwind tour of this. Questions about that?
So,
yeah.
Why do you have the absolute value there? Is that supposed to be
We don't know. So when we write these delta m squareds, this means m3 squared minus m1 squared. And this means m2 squared minus m1 squared. And what this means is that I don't know whether m1 or m3 is heavier.
Okay.
And that's because in the vacuum oscillation, in the absence of CP violation, which is a small effect, in the absence of CP violation, the vacuum oscillations always go like sine squared delta in brackets delta m squared something. So we can't actually extract the whether it's positive or negative. The reason why we know this is because the sun produces a ton of electron neutrinos, and then they propagate out through the sun. So we're basically using the sun as like this giant ball of material, and the propagation effects are different between whether they're two ordering. So basically, in the original measurements of solar neutrinos, you could do a fit of which one is better, and it prefers the positive sign. So that's why 2 is always bigger than 1, but 3 can be above or below. And as I said over here earlier, when we're counting number of states, it's also possible for the lightest one to be massless. Okay, because we're measuring mass splittings, we don't actually know if the lightest one, and that neutrino oscillations will never be able to tell us. We can never learn what the actual absolute mass is. We're only going to be able to learn relative masses. Yeah.
You said one is the most electron neutrino-like.
Yes. That's right.
Least, but is there a way to make a statement about 2 and 3? Like,
so I think they're ordered, then, you know, 2 is the most muon neutrino-like, and yeah. There it's murkier because they mix a lot. So yeah, they're actually the distinction between them is not so big because of this theta 2, 3 being large. Yeah. Okay, I want to, in the last less than 10 minutes, but I think it'll be enough time to at least sketch this out. So this is the case of Dirac neutrino masses. But we might also consider the case where neutrinos have a Majorana mass. And you might say, well, I thought you couldn't give a Majorana mass to the standard model neutrinos because they carry standard model Gates charge. But the right-handed neutrinos do not carry standard model Gates charges. So there's actually nothing wrong with giving the right-handed neutrino a Majorana mass. So in our Lagrangian up there, we have this Dirac mass term where the right-handed neutrino is interacting with the left-handed neutrino. Okay. But it's also possible to say that, you know, I take my, you know, Dirac mass term. Let me just copy the notations. This was like NR dagger. Mu L plus Hermitian conjugate, but I can also add something that's like this, which is NR NR plus Hermitian conjugate. So this is the Majorana mass where the right-handed neutrino and its left-handed antiparticle are joining up to form a mass eigenstate. So this is an example of a Majorana mass. And, you know, in retrospect, maybe we should have put it there, okay, because it's allowed by my theory. The main difference is that before, lepton number was conserved. Right, I can assign my right-handed neutrino to have a lepton number 1, and the neutrino, left-handed neutrino has lepton number 1, and my Lagrangian doesn't violate that charge. But here, it's like right-handed neutrino, that definitely, if I put that in, will violate lepton number. Okay. So what this means is that I'm going to end up with my right-handed neutrinos either carrying both lepton number and anti-lepton number, or you're just violating the symmetry overall. So now what we need to do is something that's a little bit more complicated. It's still a singular value decomposition, but we need to diagonalize, you know, these two things simultaneously. Because of time, we're not going to actually do that. So after diagonalization, what we get are two neutrino states. We can call them, I don't know, psi heavy and psi light. Okay. The mass of the heavy state is about the original mass here. Okay. And I'm going to make an assumption that this Mn is much, much bigger than the Dirac mass. And remember, that's because the Dirac mass is really tiny in the standard model, in the sort of Dirac picture. And if this is much less than that, then we can just ignore it. Okay. So the interesting case is that the heavy mass is comparable to this. And something that's really interesting is that the light mass actually goes like m Dirac squared over Mn. When I diagonalize this matrix, because it's a 2x2 matrix, there are these elements that I get something like this. So in the Dirac picture, M, the mass of the neutrinos in the standard model are M Dirac. In this scenario, the mass of the standard model neutrinos are M Dirac squared over Mn. And why might that be interesting? Well, one of the reasons it's interesting is that, remember, we had this puzzle that, like, that Yukawa coupling was really tiny. And the only way I could get light standard model neutrino masses is by having a tiny Yukawa coupling. So in this model, the light ones, which we associate with the standard model neutrino masses, could be light because the right-handed neutrino Majorana mass is really heavy. So to just throw some numbers in there, if I want my standard model neutrino masses to be 0.1 eV, then here's like one option. If Mn is 3 times 10 to the 14 GeV, Y is 1. Okay. So I can actually have a large coupling between the neutrinos and the standard model Higgs, like top Yukawa size coupling. But the right-handed neutrino Majorana mass is so heavy that it suppresses the light neutrino mass. And you can kind of understand this in effective field theory context that I kind of integrate out that right-handed neutrino. I got these 1 over right-handed neutrino things in here. So this might be more aesthetically pleasing because we're not having to put small parameters into my theory. The smallness of the standard model neutrino masses emerges out of the heaviness of the Majorana mass. This number was essentially picked so that I could get Y of 1. And this is interesting because it's not too far off something called the GUT or grand unification scale. So for a while, that was kind of exciting. People thought maybe there's a connection. But you know, I can put in whatever parameters I want. So you could also imagine, like, let's say that the right-handed neutrino mass is like 300 GeV. Okay, that could be interesting, say, from the point of view of the LHC, or if somehow these right-handed neutrinos play some role in an extended electroweak sector. And now this is not Y, this is F. My Yukawa coupling is like 10 to the minus 6. So even if the Majorana neutrino is so light as to be within the range of our experiments, I get kind of electron-sized Yukawa couplings. So this is called the seesaw mechanism. And it's called that because the heavier I make the N particle, the lighter I make my standard model neutrino. So it's kind of like, you know, pushing me up, or I guess pushing you down. I don't really know how that works. But one of them, when one goes up, the other goes down, is the idea. So this, I would say, is a much more popular scenario, both because it's like, well, you can put this mass in there anyway, so why wouldn't you? But also because it maybe gives you parameters that are a little bit nicer. And this can have observable consequences. So for instance, this can lead to a process called neutrinoless double beta decay. Which again, I'm assuming you'll hear about next week, so I want to at least mention it. Where, because I'm violating lepton number, I can have processes that are like neutron, neutron goes to proton, proton, electron, electron. Okay. This definitely violates lepton number, right? I've created 2 electrons and I don't have any anti-leptons, but it conserves electric charge. I have neutral, 2 positive, 2 negative. And so you can have processes where, for instance, I have the down quark in my neutron go to an up quark. Okay. That's going to give me a W minus. That then goes into an electron and an electron neutrino. And then, you know, the problem is that if I try to do the same thing on this side, let's try and match this. You know, I have my electron, and I try to connect these neutrinos, but you're like, was this a neutrino or an antineutrino? Well, the nice thing in this Majorana picture is that the neutrino is an antineutrino. I can just link them up, and this process can happen. So it's kind of wild, right? The standard model neutrino only has a Dirac mass in this picture. But then because it mixes with the right-handed neutrino, the mass I can say is actually a Majorana mass. So neutrinos double beta decay, if we see a signal like this, that would actually allow us to distinguish this scenario from that one. Okay? Or at least it tells us that there's lepton number breaking in my theory, and then that really strongly points towards this. We're out of time, so of course there's lots more we could say, but thanks for being an amazing group that are interacting. I'm gonna be around through tomorrow as well, so happy to chat about anything that's on your mind, and let's go get coffee.
Thank you for the standard model courses, bedrock of a course, school like this, so thank you for doing such a great
thank
job.
You. Yeah.
So, another sad time we're losing, right?
So you said we're a group who are interacting, so which fields are we interacting with?
Sorry, can you say that again?
So you said that we're a group that we are interacting, which field?
You're interactive. Yeah. Oh, I hope you're interacting. Otherwise, you just let it fall through the floor. So, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So.